Well, many of you know that I've done this continuing education thing. It's lifelong learning. At least that's what I've been trying to tell my wife, because she's like, how much more school are you going to do? I'm like a professional student, you know. Honey, it's called lifelong learning for a reason. It's going to be lifelong. At least that's what I've been telling her. So I just recently took a few classes out in Wake Forest, North Carolina. And I just want to tell you, it was difficult. Very difficult. You see, at this level of coursework, you can't just slap a bunch of stuff down on a page and turn it in last minute. No, they don't take that garbage. They kind of look at you like this and say, what is this? You know, I mean, you can't turn in that stuff. We're talking about mounds of reading and pages of writing. And that writing has to be done a certain way. I mean, there's proper form and proper style. They were so intent on this that they started to assign us books. Let me show you some of these. Have any of you seen this book? It's now in the eighth edition of Turabian, A Manual for Writers. This is akin to reading the dictionary. I mean, it's painful. The Craft of Research, another winner. Are you tired yet? You're having trouble going to sleep, and you just crack page one, and it's done. Game over, right? Style, Lessons in Clarity and Grace. A nice title, terrible book. The SBL, you think I'm joking, I have to read this stuff. The SBL Handbook of Style for Ancient Near Eastern Biblical and Early Christian Studies. That's the Society of Biblical Literature. This is so you know how to do it. Publication manuals. I mean, book after book of how to have proper form, how to have proper style. Now, for many of us, maybe we think this is just our modern-day educational system, but I want to tell you, it dates all the way back to the days of Paul. Do you know that there were proper styles and proper formats for communication, even in Paul's day? I was doing a little research about his historical era, and the master of classical style and writing and speech in Paul's day was a man named Quintilian. He wrote a very famous book. He lived from 35 to 95 AD, right in the same time as Paul. He instructed all the orators. He shaped the rhetoric of his day with his book entitled Institutio Oratia.
Oh, great.
The Guide to Proper Communication and Rhetoric. Now, it's funny to read because I read a little section of this book. This is how Quintilian begins to give instruction about how people should communicate. Now, listen carefully and see if it matches up to Paul. I mean, see if Paul took notes from Quintilian. All right, here it is. Quintilian, I do not understand why they should open in such wild and exclamatory manners. When a man is asked to express his opinion on any subject, he does not, if he's sane, begin to shriek, but he endeavors as far as possible to win the assent of the man who is considering the question by courteous and natural opening. Listen, don't shriek, Quintilian says. Don't use loud or terse words, Quintilian says. Use courteous and natural openings. Now, how many of you have read the beginning of Galatians? Did Paul take notes from Quintilian? Answer? No. I mean, answer? No. Verse number 6, I am astonished, he says, that you are so quickly turning from him who called you in grace. Chapter 3, verse 1. Oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Remember, he's kind of lost the soft tones here. Chapter 1, verse 9. If anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed, Paul says. We don't have soft and eloquent speech from Paul. He gets right to the point. He's shocked, exasperated, amazed. And so he kind of just lets them have it. I mean, that's how the book of Galatians starts. If you were in community group this last week, you studied some of the openings of Paul's other letters. Or maybe you've read some in the New Testament, and you've read how Paul opens his other epistles. Actually, every other epistle or letter that Paul writes, he gives thanks for the people. He praises God for the great things that are happening in their midst in every single letter except this one. There's no soft tones. There's no courteous entry. He just begins to deal with a problem. You see, the people of Galatia had left the true gospel. They had departed from the path of God, and they had followed after false teaching. And so Paul is astounded and bewildered. He takes Quintilian's advice and throws it out the window, and he just begins to speak to these churches. Now, I do want to suggest something, and that is, regardless of what Quintilian thinks, when we're dealing with matters that are as grave as the spiritual issues that are being addressed in Galatians, I want to suggest something to you. Sometimes hard words are in order. I think sometimes, even in modern American churches, people struggle with hearing hard words. I mean, that's why there's particular places in our country, they will fill actual stadiums with 30,000 people because there is a commitment in that place not to have hard words. The leader of that organization says so. I'm not gifted to talk to people about sin. I'm gifted with encouragement, he says. So that's all he does. No hard words. But my friends, let me tell you something. Hard words can produce soft hearts. Soft words can produce what? Hard hearts. That's right. And so sometimes in the midst of our spiritual journey, you and I, sometimes we need hard words. We kind of just need someone to look us in the face and speak directly to our heart and cut away all the niceties, cut away all the softness, cut away all the courtesy, and just tell me the truth. And that's what Paul is doing to these churches. He's just going to tell them the truth, even if it's hard. And I think it's because Paul knows what's at stake here. He's not going to use flattery. He's not going to appeal to their vanity. He's just going to speak the truth about their spiritual condition. So how is this passage going to unfold? And basically what we're going to do is we're going to look at three different stops along the way. We're going to focus in on Galatians 1, verses 6 through 10. And the first thing we're going to look at, and I'm just going to kind of give you a preview, we're going to look at how the Galatians deserted the true gospel. So we'll look at the Galatians' desertion. What were they leaving behind? How were they transferring their allegiance? We're going to look at the nature of their desertion. And then next, we're going to talk about the Judaizers. And we're going to talk about their distortion. You see, they were taking the gospel and twisting it. So how were they tweaking? That's the word we use now. Not tweeting. Tweaking. How are they distorting the gospel? So the Galatians are deserting the gospel. The Judaizers are distorting the gospel. And the last thing we're going to talk about is Paul. And we'll talk about his devotion. And that's going to come in verse number 10. What is it that grounded Paul? Where did his loyalties lie? What was the nature of his devotion? So three key words to kind of take us through this text. Desertion, distortion, devotion. Okay? Let's begin with the first one. The Galatians' desertion. Notice with me Galatians chapter 1, verse 6. I am astonished that you are so quickly, here's the word you can circle, deserting Him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another one. I'm shocked. I'm befuddled. I cannot believe it, Paul says, how quickly you have deserted Him. I can't believe it. Here's Paul. It's only been a brief interval between when they accepted the true gospel and now how they've deserted to these false teachers. Paul's reeling at the bad news. We don't know where Paul was when he wrote this, but he receives news. And he's like, what? They've already left the gospel? He's reeling from the bad news, and he wants to redirect this church back to the truth. He's shocked at their desertion. And in these few verses, we learn some things about their desertion. Number one, we learn the desertion was not a consequence, it was a choice. See, sometimes people think that wandering away from God is something that happens to you. No, my friend, it's something you do. I mean, look at the text. I am astonished that you are deserting him. He's saying here that you have made this choice. Now, I'm not saying that it happens all in one morning. It's not that people wake up, and although it can. I mean, some people do this, but most people don't wake up and say, I'm just going to desert God now. I'm done. Wash my hands. No, many times it happens over time with small choices along the way. They begin to drift with the currents of false teaching, or they begin to be driven by the winds of disappointment. But whatever the case may be, there are small choices, small accommodations, small compromises that happen over time. But nonetheless, they're making these little choices. And in doing so, they are deserting the truth of the gospel. We see that this desertion is a choice simply by looking at the meaning of the word desertion. I can't believe that you're deserting. Now, when you hear that word, what's the first context you think of? A deserter. What are you thinking of? Military. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking military. Because that's where it was frequently used. That term was frequently used of someone who is in the military who leaves and changes allegiance to the enemy side. It was also used in philosophy and politics of someone who changed their opinion to an alternate side. So it's kind of like you vote for this one guy thinking he's representing this party, and then all of a sudden he switches over. You're like, wait, you just deserted. So here, the very word meaning means that these people made a choice to turn their allegiance from the true gospel to something else. And not only that, the grammar shows it. The point of this verb, deserting, it's a, I don't want to like get off track, but it's a present active verb, which means they are the ones doing it. It's not something that's happening to them. They were not, maybe I can put it this way, they were not deserted upon. You just don't understand, Pastor, I was deserted upon. Found myself way over here. There was this desertion vehicle and it picked me up and I don't know how it happened. No. The fact is you did it. You did the deserting. They were not victims of extra ecclesiastical desertion attacks. They were not hauled off by desertion vehicles. They were not held captive. They were not taken hostage. They deserted. That's the point here. They made a choice. It's a choice, not a consequence. And I want to say, lest we think we're above making such a choice, let's remember the stories of Scripture. My friends, can we be sobered this morning that we too could be tempted to desert from the truth of the gospel? And in your own minds, can you think of some of the biblical characters who deserted from the truth or who were warned about not deserting from the truth? I mean, I'm thinking about Timothy. Paul warns Timothy, his protege. Listen, don't desert from the truth. It's in 2 Timothy. He writes to this young pastor, 2 Timothy 2, verses 3 and 4. And then later on in 4:10, he says, share in the sufferings as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. No soldier gets entangled in civilian pursuits since his aim is to please the one who enlisted him. And later on in that book, he says, now listen, Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me. Demas had been a co-laborer with Paul. What did he end up doing? He ended up deserting. And Paul warns Timothy, don't be like him. Stand fast. Think about one of the disciples. Do you remember one of the disciples who was warned about desertion? Probably the lead disciple, the head of the pack. His name was Peter. Peter, Jesus says, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. Peter got right to the brink of desertion, didn't he? He's warming his hands by a fire. He's denying that he even knows Jesus Christ. Right to the brink of desertion. Oh, my friends, let us not think that we're beyond it, that we're above it in some way. Desertion is not a consequence. It's a choice. Desertion is not intellectual. It's personal. Sometimes I think people wander away and they just say, well, I've been thinking about a different idea. I've come up with a different concept of God. I've rethought religion. And so they think it's like this intellectual thing. No, my friends, desertion is not intellectual. Desertion is personal. Notice the text, if you would. Verse number 6. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting... What's the next word? You are deserting him. I think that's interesting. Because when I first read this, I'm thinking, oh, they're deserting the gospel. And they were. But in essence, they were actually deserting the God of the gospel. It's not just an intellectual shift that happens in people's minds. It's a relational shift away from God. Some people want to privatize their religion. They want to personalize their expression. They want to individualize their understanding of the gospel and still think that they can love Jesus and believe in God and everything's okay. No, my friend, if you desert from the gospel, you desert from the God of the gospel. It's a personal thing. To abandon gospel theology is to abandon God personally. You can't do your own thing and still think that you're buddy-buddy with God. You can't believe wrong things and still think you're okay with Him. This is a personal thing. What you do in theology eventually affects your experience. What I mean by that is what you believe doctrinally will have an impact on how you relate to Jesus personally. That's why doctrine matters so much. There are some places they have no time for doctrine. They don't care about doctrine. Oh, my friends, you don't get it then. Your doctrine affects your experience. You can't say, well, I'm just going to walk away from these intellectual concepts into a more close relationship with God. No, it doesn't work that way, my friends. This is not an intellectual desertion. It's a personal desertion. You're actually walking away from Him. If your understanding of doctrine diminishes, your relationship with Christ will diminish. Desertion. So far we've learned that it's not a consequence, it's a choice, it's not intellectual, it's personal. Desertion. It's not a benign alternative. It's rather a harmful and ultimately fatal decision. You say, well, I'm just going to try another path. Oh, okay. As though trying other paths is okay. Like it's like flipping a coin. It's like go this way or go this way. No big deal. It's a benign alternative. There's no ramifications. I'll just try another way. No, my friends, when you read this text, what you're going to find out is that to desert from the true gospel is deserting from Christ, and to do that is both harmful and fatal. Let's see if we can unpack that from the text. Notice verse 6 again. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting Him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. And then notice this phrase, not that there is another one. It seems as though there's this intentional allusion to an Old Testament story that's going on here that you may not pick up, but the Jewish readers would have. It happens to be with a few words. One is in verse 4. I want to back up. We covered this last week. It's the word deliver. In verse number 4, it says, who gave himself for our sins to deliver. And I showed last week that actually that word is the same word that's used in Exodus, when God delivered his people out of bondage in Egypt. Remember that? It was the same word that's used there, deliver, the exodus of the children of Israel. But then when you get down to verse 6, you could circle the word quickly. Because the word quickly was the same word that was used of the people of Israel when they quickly deserted the truth of God and the commandments of God during the exodus. Do you remember when that was? If you've read the story of the Bible, you come across this occurrence of the children of Israel. They're leaving Egypt. They're heading towards the promised land. They stop at the base of a mountain called Sinai. And at the base of that mountain, Moses is commanded by God to go up to the mountain to receive the law of God. The people are down below. They're told to wait. Wait and worship. Because remember, a cloud fills the top of that. I mean, there's shaking and rumbling and earthquakes. I mean, they know that God is at work. Wait and worship. But while Moses is gone, they quickly desert. Do you remember that? They quickly deserted. They say, Aaron, come here. What we need you to do is we need you to take all of our earrings and all of our bracelets and all this, these rings and stuff. We need you to boil them down, and we need you to fashion for us a golden calf. Do you remember that? Well, this word quickly is used in that very same passage. It's in Exodus 32:8. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. That's what God says in response to the desertion of these Israelites. Well, it's a harmful desertion. It's harmful in the sense that it's going to bring pain. Pain to the heart of those who introduced you to Christ. Pain to the heart of those who mentored you. Those who discipled you. Many times when we desert, when we walk away, or when people do this, they don't give thought to those who have invested into their lives. The only person they're thinking about is themselves. This is where I want to go. This is what I want to think. This is what I want to do. Yeah, well, that's wonderful. Don't you remember how Paul suffered to plant these churches? Remember, I traced this last week. He's beaten. He's run out of town. He's even stoned and thought to be dead. Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Paul. I'm going to go over here. Can you imagine the pain in Paul's heart when he had invested so much in these people to train them up in the ways of God, to lead them in the path of truth, and here they were deserting? Have you ever had that experience where someone that you've discipled, someone that you've trained, someone that you've taught, someone you've ministered to, they just veer off the path? Friends, when that happens, it causes great pain to those who have invested in you. It is interesting to me to read about how Paul feels towards those he has invested in, towards those he has ministered Christ to. In one passage, actually in this book, in the book of Galatians, he actually refers to himself kind of like, he says, I'm kind of like a mother in labor pains for you. That's what he says. I mean, you want to read it. It's in Galatians 4:19. Galatians 4:19 and 20. He says, my little children, for whom I am again in the anguish of childbirth until Christ is formed in you. I mean, he is anguishing. He is in labor. He is in pain over them. Oh, that Christ would be formed in you, he says. Paul relates to them kind of like a mother would relate to this child. In other passages of Scripture, he talks about these churches. He talks to them like he's their father. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 14, I do not write these things to make you ashamed, but to admonish you as my beloved children. For though you have countless guides in Christ, you do not have many fathers. For I became your father in Christ Jesus through the gospel. What's he saying? He said, listen, I introduced you to Christ. You received new birth because I ministered the message of the gospel, kind of like a spiritual father to you. Imagine how it feels, a father to watch his child stray from the path, or a mother to watch her child who they labored in travail over swerve from the truth. Imagine the pain it brings. Listen, my friends, when you desert, it's not just a benign alternative. It's going to cause pain. It will do harm. But not just harm. It's not just a harmful decision. It's a fatal decision. I want to bring you to that. Notice verse 7. End of verse 6, he says, you are turning to a different gospel. And then verse 7, he says, not that there is another one. So he's watching these people, and they're turning to another gospel. He says, but it's not really a gospel. They're turning to another. You know what the word gospel means? It means good news. You're turning to another good news, but it's not good news. And ultimately, since it's not good news, it's bad news, and it will be fatal. I mean, that's kind of his point. I was thinking about how to, so how do I illustrate this? This is my best shot at it, okay? You're standing in the hall up at University Hospital, right outside the ER. And you're watching this event unfold. Now, I know there's a medical doctor here. Don't correct my, I don't know anything about medicine. I just made this up. A man comes in. He has multiple snake bites, poisonous snakes. He's swelling up. His heart rate's going out of control. His esophagus is constricting. And the doctor offers him a shot of antivenom. He says, I don't want that stuff. I want a shot of saline. Doctor shakes his head. He's like, saline's not going to do anything for you. Well, the patient kind of barks back. I want some other shot, not that antivenom. Well, in that moment, the doctor looks at this poisonous, snake-bitten patient and says this, you are turning to a different antidote. Not that there is another antidote. Okay, you want a saline shot? Great. There's your antidote, but it's not really an antidote. And what's going to be the end? Fatality. Oh, you want a tetanus shot? Great. That's not an antidote. What's going to be the end? Fatality. You want the flu mist? Okay. What's going to be the end? Fatality. Do you see what he's saying here? Okay, you don't want the truth? You want to go to this other thing that calls itself the truth? It's not the truth. It's not the good news. And the end of that path is death. That's what Paul is saying here. It is a fatal choice to desert from the true gospel. What he's saying in this passage so far is that desertion is a choice, not a consequence. Desertion is personal, not just intellectual. And then he's saying that desertion is harmful and ultimately fatal, not just a benign alternative. That's what Paul is saying when he addresses the desertion of the Galatians. But he moves on through this passage because although the Galatians were deserting the gospel, it was linked to the fact that the Judaizers were perverting the gospel. So you see some deserting the gospel, but it was linked to the fact that these other ones, these false teachers, they were perverting the gospel. And so the next thing that Paul deals with here is the Judaizers and their distortion of the truth. The Judaizers, I mean, how do we describe them? Well, they would have been like Christian Jewish missionaries who mixed up the true message of the gospel. And they left from Jerusalem and followed after the places where Paul went. And they went to these places where Paul had planted these churches, and they said, well, we're here, and we've known the truth for a long time. I mean, listen, we're Jews. We've had the law for over 1,000 years. We know what's up. And all the stuff that Paul's preached, so far as it goes, it's okay. But if you really want the full gospel, if you really want to be complete, if you want to improve your spirituality, if you want to bring it to its fullness, then what you really need to do is add the law. So add the law to the gospel. And we know, because we're Jews and we've had the law for a long time, listen to us. And that's what these guys were doing. They were like Jewish Christian missionaries following after Paul with the wrong message. It was false teaching. You can't add anything to the gospel. You can't add anything to the work of Jesus by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. You can't add anything to that. Well, that's what these Judaizers were trying to do. Now, lest we think that false teachers are a thing of the past, I want to tell you that there are false teachers who are alive and well today. They're not all wearing little name tags that say, hi, I'm a false teacher. They're not all wearing sandwich boards that say, hi, I'm a false teacher. They don't all do that. Some of them have gospel language that could be confusing. Some of them use synonymous words where, like, well, they're kind of talking like, they're kind of saying some of the same. Listen, there are all kinds of false gospels out there today. There are gospels of material prosperity today. They teach that Jesus is the way to financial gain. My friends, that's a false gospel. There are gospels about family values today. They teach that Jesus is the way to have a happy home or even an eternal family. That's a false gospel. Some promote a gospel of self-improvement. Jesus is the way to find personal fulfillment and your best life now. That is a false gospel. There are gospels of morality. They teach that Jesus is the way to be a good person. Or gospels of historic virtues. They teach that Jesus can take America back to its Christian roots through current political systems. My friends, these are false gospels. Now, they may have components that may be admirable. They may have parts that we would say, well, I think that that's... But listen, that's not the core of the gospel. There are false gospels today, just as there were in the first century. And if you take the gospel of the New Testament and add anything to it, or change its course even a little bit, then you end up with no gospel at all. Notice with me verse number 7. Verse number 7. Not that there is another one. Not that there is another gospel. But there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. What's going on with these false teachers? What are they doing? Well, these false teachers are seeking to distort the gospel. They call themselves Christians, but they are not. They call their message the gospel, but it is not. My friends, just because it claims to be Christian, can you finish the sentence? Doesn't mean it is. Just because it claims to be gospel doesn't mean it is. It's kind of like that commercial about the internet. Well, if it's on the internet, it must be true. You remember the French model or whatever he is? It's like this hideous dude, and he's got a really beautiful girlfriend because she saw on the internet that he was a French model. It was like, it's hilarious. It was on the internet. It must be true. It's on their sign. It says Christian. I mean, the book subtitle says gospel. Oh, my friends, just because it says so doesn't mean it is. It must be taken through the grid. These Judaizers, they would have had gospel lingo. They would have used Christianese. The same terminology, but they would have added to the gospel, and therefore they have no gospel at all. They were distorting the truth. I think it's tough because false teachers are tricky and sly. They make similar claims and they agree with you on a lot of points. They can even appear to be messengers of light. Do you remember this passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14? Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. That's what Paul says. False teachers are tricky because they don't just come out and say, oh, hey, we've got a false message. They don't say that. They purport the truth, but it's mixed with some lies. It's distorted and twisted in some way. Let's look at a few things that Paul surfaces about these false teachers, these Judaizers and their distortion. The first thing I'd like to show you is that false teachers trouble the church. Notice with me in verse number 7, the second half of the verse, there are some who trouble you. They trouble the church. The word trouble means to shake or agitate. They stir it up. They unsettle the church. I mean, my first picture in my mind is I go out to my Suburban. Liesl has brought home all the groceries. And I think to myself, I'll carry all the groceries in one trip so I don't have to make two. You do that. I mean, you attach a bag to your earlobe. You got one on your toe. You're hopping. You're trying to carry all this crazy stuff, right? And so I'm trying to carry all this stuff. And there's a soda or two liters, and they're in one of the bags. And the bag rips, and I'm still trying to carry all this stuff. I can't do it. And one of the bottles of soda, the 2 liter, falls on the ground and just hits and bounces and rolls, and you just watch it. I mean, you know the whole thing is shaken up. Right? I mean, it's unsettled. Now, you don't open that one right away, right? You have to let it calm down. But you know that that thing has been shaken up. It has been troubled. That's this word here. These false teachers will come in and they will trouble. They'll stir up. They'll shake up the church. And I think that the reason that they want to do that is because twisted truth finds a home most readily in troubled souls. If you have a troubled soul, twisted truth finds its way in. So if you're solid and you're steady and you're stable, then false teaching is not going to have a way in. But if we can shake things up in the church, if we can trouble the congregation, then we'll find our way in. I'm trying to think through my last visit up to Park City when they were doing those Olympic training jumps. Have any of you ever seen the ones in Olympic Village where they flip off those jumps? I'm the only person who's ever gone up there. My friends, we live in Utah. There's this place called Olympic Village. It's in Park City. You should visit it. It's kind of cool. So I'm up there. It's summertime, and they're practicing ski jumps. And they do this with these special ramps where they put water in them, and they go down, and they have life jackets on, and they jump, flip, and do all this crazy stuff. Well, the thing that caught my attention when I watched this is how they land, because you're like, well, there's no snow, right? What do they land in? They land in a big pool of water. But it's not just any pool. You know, it's actually a special pool. Does anyone remember seeing that thing and what they do? There are these sensors so that when that ski jumper comes down, he flips off this thing. These sensors are hit, and there are these pipes on the bottom of the pool, and they shoot up air before the ski jumper lands into the water. And what it does is it breaks up all the surface tension. Breaks up the surface tension so that the skier can go down into the water and not like hit flat like on cement, you know what I mean? Just pound into that water that's unbroken. So it breaks up the water, it stirs it up, it troubles the water so that the skier can go down in. I want to tell you something. False teaching does that. It wants to break up the surface tension, wants to stir up the church so that false teaching can find its home. That's what these teachers do. And if you read the New Testament, you'll find that happens over and over and over again. I want to tell you something. Beware of someone who comes into the church and seeks to unsettle the flock. Beware of a person who begins to stir up the church, because that is making it susceptible to false teaching. Well, that's what he says. There are some who come in among you and they're troubling you, he says. And troubled souls, they are susceptible to twisted truth. Well, they trouble the flock and then they twist the gospel. There are some who trouble you, they want to distort, he says, or twist the gospel of Christ. So they trouble the flock. They twist the gospel. What were they doing here? Well, they were revising the gospel of Christ. My friends, when you revise the gospel, you actually reverse the gospel. You can't revise it without reversing it. You can't modify it, adjust it, add to it, enhance it, make it better, take it to its next level. We'll do the beta version. You can't do that without messing it up. The gospel is like a vacuum in which there's no air. You can't let just a little bit of air in and say, well, it's an air-enriched vacuum. No, it's not a vacuum at all. I mean, once any air gets in, it's no longer what it was. So it is with the gospel. The gospel is what it is, and as soon as you let anything else in, as soon as you add to it even a little bit, it's no longer what it is supposed to be. I'm imagining a house of cards. Have any of you ever tried to build a house of cards? You've watched people do it. You've wished you could do it. You wish you had a table steady enough to do it. You wish you'd stop shaking so much so that you could do it. I mean, have you ever seen that? I mean, they stack these cards like this, and then they put one on top. You see people work for a long time on this. Have you ever seen, have you ever seen those master domino things where they set up these dominoes, makes this huge thing, covers rooms, you know, where you hit one domino and the whole thing goes? And you're seeing people, yeah, it's getting down to the end and they're like putting one down. And then you have a three-year-old little sister who decides they're going to enhance it. They're going to add to your house of cards. They're going to make your domino setup a little bit better, right? No, we all know that's not what happens, because as soon as they try to add to it, they destroy the whole thing. So it is with false teachers, my friends. They begin to add to the gospel, and in so doing, they destroy the whole thing. Well, where is it that we see a revised and a reversed gospel today? I want to say this. The gospel has two main components that you must remember. One, we are too sinful to add anything to our account. We are far too depraved to contribute anything to our own salvation. That is why in Galatians chapter 1, verse 4, it says we must be delivered. We must be rescued. We can't do it ourselves. That's the first component of the gospel. And the second component of the gospel is that we are saved by Jesus' gracious work and nothing else. And there are false gospels today who seek to revise and reverse by attacking one of those two components. They mess with one of those two. So you see things today where there are gospels, they revise the system by saying things like, salvation is based on your level of faith. Did you catch that? That's a false gospel. Salvation is not based on your level of faith. They teach things like, well, if you have a strong enough belief, if your trust and your love for God is great enough, if you are thoroughly committed in your life enough, then you will be saved. Friends, the gospel is not about the level of your faith. It is about the object of your faith. That is a false gospel. You can't contribute to your own salvation. Remember, you're far too sinful. It's only the work of Christ. False gospels today. They're revising things and therefore they're reversing them. Or how about this? How about this revised system? Those who claim that salvation is based on the extent of one's goodness. So they seem to suggest that if you're good and if you're loving, if you're kind and if you're neighborly, then God will save you. Folks, if goodness saves you, then it's about your virtue and not about Christ's work. If only good people are saved, then you and I would have no hope. Neither would Paul. I mean, you just keep reading this chapter. He talks about who he was before Christ. No. Salvation's not just for the good. It's for the godless, the hopeless, the helpless. It's for people like us. What other systems are there out there that are false gospels, revising and therefore reversing the gospel? Well, it's those who proclaim that salvation is based on a degree of ritual or religious observance. In other words, they teach, if you follow these rules, if you practice these rituals, if you observe these regulations, then you'll be saved. They teach things like, so tithe, take sacrament, carry the right Bible, get a recommend, wear the correct clothes, go on a mission, make sure you're sealed, answer your calling, follow the seven sacraments, be a member of this particular congregation, hope that these things will add to your salvation. That is not a true gospel. That is a gospel of works and not a gospel of grace. So how do we recognize the true gospel? Because Paul is very concerned about this. How do we recognize the true gospel? Well, we need to notice its substance. The true gospel is a gospel of grace. What is at the core of this fruit called the gospel? At the core of it is grace. Grace that's free. Grace that's unmerited. You can look at passages like Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. Titus 3, 5. Whenever a teacher starts to exalt man, or begins to imply that we can contribute anything to our own salvation by morality, religion, philosophy, respectability, well, then the gospel of grace is being corrupted. The substance of the true gospel is grace. And then Paul will go on and he'll say the source. That's the second thing. How do we know the true gospel? The source. The source of the true gospel is the New Testament teaching of the apostles. That's what he's going to make a claim for. It's in the New Testament. The Bible becomes our plumb line for judging different truth claims. Do you want a grid? Do you want to know how all these different people who claim to be the true gospel, they claim to have real truth, how do you know which one is right? I think some of you maybe have wondered that. You've looked at all of these voices that are calling out to you saying, this is truth, this is truth, this is truth, this is truth. Be part of this, follow this. Join this, assemble here, do that. How do you know which one? Well, it's the gospel grid found in the New Testament. That's what Paul is going to say in verses 8 and 9. The gospel grid found in the New Testament judges the church. It judges human authority. It judges personal experience to tell you what is the truth. The Bible is how we know the truth. How do you know the truth? Well, I just feel this way. No, that's not how you know the truth. It's here. Well, my church says it's true. No, that's not how you know the truth. The truth is here. Well, there was a pope, there was a prophet, there was a priest, there was a pastor. He told me, nope, the truth is here. This is it. The substance of the gospel is grace. The source of the gospel is here. That's what Paul says when it comes to these false teachers. These false teachers are troubling the church and they're twisting the gospel. And finally, they must not be tolerated. They must not be tolerated. What we have is an exclusive gospel. This next week, when we gather together, I'd like to dive into verses 8 and 9. And what we're going to find there is that Paul is going to make a claim that there is only one gospel. How does that sit with you? Listen, that's kind of closed-minded. That's kind of myopic, Lucas. It's kind of pious. You're a little bit proud, aren't you? You think you have a corner on the market? What is this, Monopoly? No, my friends, it's not about what I think. And it's not about what I believe. It's actually about what the scriptures say. We live in a world that has the greatest value, and their greatest value is called tolerance. I'm going to tell you something. You're going to find in verses 8 and 9 that Paul is intolerant of false gospels because he knows what's at stake. He knows that if you believe a false gospel, then you make Christ's death of no worth. He knows that if you believe a false gospel, then your soul is in danger. He's not going to let you believe a false gospel. And so next week when we gather together, we're going to look at how these teachers must not be tolerated. We're going to notice together how Paul expresses his own devotion to Christ. Well, today, as we wrap things up, we understand that the Galatians, they were walking away from, they were deserting the true gospel. And we must not. And we know that the Judaizers, they were distorting the true gospel. And we must not tolerate.